children here try their best to have a good time. Florence Curry was one of the guests at a party earlier this month organized by the YMCA in Gaza City. She said, "Turning on the Christmas tree lights has a special meaning in Gaza. We love life despite all the darkness caused by the Zionist regime."
Communique.
Last week, the seventh round of talks began in Vienna. Over the weekend, the various parties went home for consultations, and now they've returned. This has been the second week of negotiations for Iran to try and get the U.S. back into the deal that Donald Trump tore up in 2018 and to end the maximum pressure campaign that Biden has continued in his place. As I mentioned last time, Vienna is packed with luxury hotels, very fancy hotels, and every participant in these talks is staying at a different one. I'm standing in front of the Intercontinental, where the Iranian delegation is staying. Meanwhile, the talks are taking place just over there at the Palais Kobour. Now, last week, I spoke with Professor Merendi, who's advising the Iranian delegation. This week, I sat down with Dr. Baghdadi, Iran's chief negotiator. He's tasked with representing Iran at these talks and forging the best possible outcome for Iran's interests. That means getting the United States to respect the deal they signed together in 2015 and to lift all sanctions. I asked him how the talks were progressing, about Iran's recent draft proposals, threats and intimidation by Israel, and whether Iran could trust the Americans not to break the deal again if they actually go back in. Dr. Baghdadi, first of all, welcome to Vienna, and thank you for taking the time to sit down and do this interview with me. The first question I wanted to ask you is, you have now resumed the seventh round of nuclear negotiations, talks to get sanctions lifted. This is the first time you're leading this delegation under the new Raisi government. What are you doing differently compared to your predecessors who were here 5 months ago?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
What we are emphasizing in this round of negotiations, and what has been already emphasized by the President of the Islamic Republic of Iran and other senior officials, is that in the Vienna talks, our main priority is to remove the illegal and cruel sanctions which have been imposed and reinstated against the Iranian nation during the past several years. The sanctions imposed and reimposed by the United States against the Iranian nation are in violation of the international law and regulations, as well as principles, and an international agreement called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, as well as the provisions of the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231. In addition to Iran, other members of the group 4 plus 1 and even the new U.S. administration, they all agree and confess that the previous administration of the United States did a wrongdoing in pulling out of the JCPOA, and for this reason, the new administration, the Biden administration, wants to return from that mistake, and they want to return to the 2015 agreement.
And speaking of these unilateral sanctions that have been imposed by the United States, you've submitted two draft proposals just last week, one on sanctions removal and the other one on Iran's nuclear commitments. Has there been any progress with these draft proposals, and when can we expect to see a third? What would be in the third?
During six rounds of negotiations in Vienna in the past, ultimately the two sides drafted some texts, several texts. Two of them were about the removal of sanctions and Iran's nuclear commitment. There was presidential elections in Iran. There was a new government in power. There was a new approach, new priorities in various areas, including the foreign policy. And it was normal that the new government, the new administration, would have some observations and modifications with regard to the text drafted on the 20th of June this year. And on the basis of this, the Iranian side incorporated its observations and modifications on the sanctions removal and on the nuclear commitments into the draft documents concluded in 20th of June 2021. In one of the drafts of the 20th of June, which was on the nuclear commitments of Iran, there were numerous differences between the two parties. And the draft text of nuclear commitments included and contained a lot of brackets which indicated differences in approach between the two parties. The modifications formulated by the new Iranian team on the text on nuclear commitments were much less than the differences and issues of differences which existed in the original 20th of June document. And since the beginning of the new negotiations, as of 29th of November, various sessions and working groups were held at the experts level and senior political directors level in order to discuss both the drafts. And during the past days, there have been a lot of sessions of the Working Group on Nuclear Commitments in order to identify the differences in the draft text on nuclear commitments within the framework, within a specific framework, and in order to restrict and limit the number of differences. And on such a basis, there is still ongoing negotiations between the two sides in order to finalize the issue of differences between the two sides so that we enter into negotiations to remove those differences. And very good progress have been made, as with the meetings which had been taking place since several days ago.
The Russian ambassador and permanent representative to the United Nations in Vienna is Mikhail Yulianov. He's also taking part in the Vienna talks. I interviewed him just a few months ago. Now, just earlier, he posted on Twitter that journalists were misinterpreting his comments and twisting his words. He said that, quote, many diplomats don't like to give interviews in order to be on the safe side. Probably they're right. This evening, I was in a rush, but provided comments to journalists at their request. I was misinterpreted. Be aware that I assess positively, not negatively, the position of Iran. In another tweet, he said that to my surprise, some analysts and journalists described the situation at the Vienna talks as dramatic, almost deadlock. This is not the case in point. He also described the atmosphere of the talks as positive. Last week, when I interviewed Professor Marandi, who's advising the Iranian delegation, we spoke at length about how inundated the media is with propaganda, Orientalist rhetoric, and spin doctors trying to derail the talks, portraying Iran as uncooperative or non-compliant, dragging its feet. Now, while speaking to Dr. Baghri, I asked him as well about recent reports in the media from anonymous U.S. officials who had made negative comments about the talks. He told me that what we're dealing with are two completely different realities, that what is said outside in the Western press and what's actually happening at the negotiating table are two completely different things. He said the same parties who attacked Iran's nuclear facilities, meaning Israel, were trying to derail the talks and poison the constructive atmosphere that they've reached in the negotiating room. In terms of what was drafted in June and what's being drafted now, there are American officials, anonymous officials talking to the press who say that Iran has basically pocketed all the beneficial concessions, the things that are good for Iran, and dropped all the other things, and that Iran is buying time, trying to waste time with the negotiations. I mean, this doesn't reflect what you just told me, where there's progress being made. Where do these opinions come from? What are they based on in the Western press?
We are presently facing two atmospheres, two places. one atmosphere or space is inside the negotiating room and one is outside. Inside the negotiating room, there are specific parties that are negotiating and they are already clear. But outside the negotiating room, it is not clear which identities are operating and what are they doing. The same escalatory identities that targeted Iran's nuclear facilities in terrorist operations and terrorist attacks, the same escalatory identities are trying to seriously provide obstacles and create obstacles on the progress of nuclear negotiation. And in addition of trying to poison the atmosphere outside the negotiating room, they are hoping that they would be able to provide a disconstructive or non-constructive atmosphere also inside the room.
The way most people think of the Vienna talks, they think of the following parties being involved: Iran, China, Russia, the US, UK, France, Germany, and the EU. But there is an additional entity involved, an outside actor affecting the negotiations and placing its thumb on the scale, and that is undeniably Israel. It is no secret that Israel isn't a fan of the nuclear deal. It has been opposing the JCPOA from the very beginning. Whenever there have been negotiations, Israel has gone to the U.S. and attempted to derail the talks by speaking with U.S. officials and asking them to quit. And of course, we've gone over the numerous acts of assassination and sabotage that Israel has carried out against Iran over the years. Now, just in the last days, while talks are happening here in Vienna, the head of the Israeli occupation forces, Benny Gantz, is said to have drawn up plans for a military strike against Iran, that he had informed the Americans of this. I wanted to know how Israel's past aggressions and transgressions against Iran and these new threats that have surfaced during the recent days factored into the negotiations.
Speaking of these provocateurs, people who are trying to escalate the situation, Israel in the last years, they've killed Iranian nuclear scientists, they've committed acts of cyber attacks, acts of nuclear terrorism, sabotage in nuclear facilities. How is that factored into the talks? Does this even come up during the talks? Because the United States has participated with Israel on these attacks. And what's your reaction to these statements coming out in the last days that Israel is basically preparing a plan B or some kind of backup plan, which would include military action in case the talks in Vienna don't work out?
It is already crystal clear that Zionists are trying very seriously in order to have a negative, a non-constructive, and destructive atmosphere inside the negotiating room. They are pursuing the same destructive measures, as I mentioned, outside the negotiating room. And for this reason, the Zionist regime authorities are trying to spread the role of such a destructive role to the players which may have an influence inside the negotiating room. And some of these players are having some sort of contradictory behavior. On one hand, they are saying that we are negotiating in order to resurrect the deal and the United States returns to the deal. And on the other hand, they are either authoring and writing joint press opinions and articles and participate in long-hour meetings with that illegitimate entity in order to destroy the negotiations or create serious obstacles on the way of progress of negotiations. And any impediment or obstacle on the way of the progress of negotiations should be blamed on the players which provide the Zionist regime with the chance, with the opportunity, with the capacity and possibility to conduct destructive and non-constructive measures on the progress of negotiations.
Dr. Bagheri, you mentioned this kind of contradictory behavior. Something that stands out is in the last week, the United States has imposed more sanctions on Iran while there are talks ongoing to lift sanctions on Iran. The Biden administration said it would rejoin the JCPOA. Biden's been president for almost a year. That's still not happened. And he's kept the maximum pressure campaign that Trump put in place. Again, how do you reconcile these contradictory positions coming from the Americans?
We also believe that this is a contradictory and double-sided behavior by the U.S. government, and we believe that this is the U.S. administration which should explain about such contradictions in their behavior.
The follow-up that I wanted to ask you is that in terms of sanctions removal, the United States, they have various labels, right? So now they have nuclear-related sanctions, non-nuclear-related sanctions. Is their position still that they're only going to lift the nuclear-related sanctions and everything else stays?
Still on the issue of sanctions and removal of sanctions, the process of serious and real negotiations have not yet started. Of course, several drafts have been exchanged between the two sides. But what is clear and what is significant is that from our point of view, any sanction which is in contradiction and inconsistent with the JCPOA and the nuclear deal should be removed immediately. Either these sanctions have been imposed during Obama or Trump or Biden administrations, all of them should be removed. The same case applies with all the sanctions which are somehow related to the JCPOA, and they also need to be lifted. And on the same basis, all the sanctions which have been imposed under the so-called maximum pressure campaign by the U.S. administration, they need to be removed because they are related to the JCPOA.
Over the weekend, Robert Malley, who's heading the negotiations on the U.S. side, gave an interview to Al Jazeera. He said that because Iran's nuclear program is so advanced, that, quote, time was running out.
As I've said before, this is a technological clock. It's not a chronological clock. In other words, if they slow down their nuclear program, we'd have more time. If they continue at the current pace, then time is running out. Secretary Blinken has made that clear over and over again. Time is running out, and we and the Europeans will have to conclude, if Iran continues on down this path, that they have killed the JCPOA, and the JCPOA would be no more.
Germany's new foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, gave a similar comment. Speaking at the G7 in England, she said that, quote, we do not have any progress. Due to the offer of the Iranian government, negotiations have been thrown back 6 months. She also added that time was running out. Now, the consensus among Western countries is that time is running out and Iran needs to do the right thing and come back into compliance. When I spoke last week with Professor Merendi, he told me that it's time for the Americans and Europeans to grasp that time is not on their side. Despite the discomfort, Iran has learned to live with sanctions to manage the maximum pressure campaign against it, and it has more leverage now with its nuclear program than ever before.
As I said, the maximum pressure campaign, despite the hardship, but the economy has sort of, you know, it's adjusted. And Iran is increasingly looking to live with sanctions rather than live in hope of the removal of sanctions. So that I think gradually the sanctions regime will become increasingly less influential.
I asked Dr. Baghri what he thought about Robert Malley's comments and how Iran would potentially scale back its program if, say, the U.S. rejoined the accord tomorrow. He told me that Iran was doing nothing covert, that the program is completely remedial and operating fully within the framework of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and the Safeguards Agreement. He added that once the Americans lift their sanctions, Iran has no problem reversing the remedial measures that it has taken.
The argument from the West, from the Americans, is that Iran is moving too quickly with its nuclear program. I believe Robert Malley, who's a special envoy of the U.S. to Iran, he said that this is not a chronological problem, it's a technological clock that's in place, that basically Iran needs to slow down its nuclear program. How do you plan on, let's say, for example, tomorrow morning the JCPOA is back in place with the Americans, they return. How would Iran basically scale back its nuclear program and get back to where it was before? And, what is your response to this idea that Iran is breaching the agreement, even though Iran is still in the JCPOA?
All the nuclear activities of Iran are being undertaken within the framework of the NPT and the Safeguards Agreement. And all the nuclear activities of Iran comprehensively are being inspected by the IAEA authorities. Iran does not have any secret nuclear activities. And the nuclear activities Iran is taking at the moment is exactly compatible with the JCPOA, because paragraphs 26 and 36 of the JCPOA entitles Iran in order to wholly or partially suspend its activities if the other party fails to fulfill its commitments. We have announced earlier and we reiterated that our reactions are remedial, and we started our nuclear activities 1 year after the United States pulled out of the nuclear agreement. When the Americans remove the illegal sanctions against Iran, grounds will be paved for Iran to stop its remedial activities.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
When Trump quit the JCPOA in 2018, he reimposed sanctions on Iran, targeting its oil and banking sectors, which have taken a heavy toll on Iran's economy and standard of living. Iran has over 1,500 U.S. sanctions on it, more than all other countries combined. One of the Iranians' main concerns right now at the negotiations is trusting that the Americans will actually stay in the deal and abide by it if they rejoin. Iran wants a comprehensive verification method for sanctions relief, a guarantee that whoever succeeds Biden in the Oval Office won't just tear up the accord again and target Iran with what is essentially siege warfare. In 2010, Iran ranked sixth globally in attracting foreign direct investments. When the nuclear deal was reached, many Western and international firms invested billions in Iran, only to see their investments go down the drain when the U.S. left the deal in 2018 and placed sanctions again on the Islamic Republic, making it impossible to interact with Iran without fear of reprisal. You can see here in 2015 how foreign investment in Iran was climbing, and then suddenly a sharp decline in 2019 with the departure of the U.S. and reimposition of sanctions the year before. You can understand the reluctance of foreign firms to go through such a debacle again, given the uncertainty of the Americans and their actions, not to mention how it affects Iranians themselves and their well-being. I asked Dr. Baghri why he should trust the United States this time, and how he plans on making sure the Americans hold up their end of the deal if they come back to it at all.
So, Dr. Baghri, the JCPOA, it has a mechanism to verify with the IAEA that Iran complies with the agreement, with the accord. What's the mechanism to verify that the Americans will comply with whatever agreement is reached, if it's just returning back to the simple JCPOA? How will Iran be able to verify that the Americans are actually lifting the sanctions? How can you make sure that the next American administration in 2025 is not just going to come in and quit the JCPOA again and put sanctions on Iran again?
There are very differences of opinions and difference issues in the draft text provided in the 20th of June. The issues you referred to, the issue of guarantees and the issue of verification, are one of those differences which have not yet been resolved, and they should be resolved in the course of negotiations in order to conclude a mutually agreed deal.
So just as a last question, what is the biggest obstacle for the JCPOA to be re-implemented in full by everybody?
I believe that if the other party is enjoying a serious determination and practical preparedness in order to fulfill all its obligations within the framework of the JCPOA without any exception, then I truly believe that within a short span of time, we would be able to reach a mutually agreed deal.
Dr. Baghri, thank you so much for your time and for sitting down with us for this interview. I really appreciate it.
I would also to thank you and your viewers.
Thank you. What's clear in covering these talks is that there's a lot of back and forth, a huge blame game being played. The Americans and Europeans want Iran to scale back its nuclear program before they do anything,
But Iran is also unequivocal and wants the Americans to get back in the deal first. Dr. Baghri, Iran's chief negotiator, told me that everything Iran is doing is within the framework of the NPT, the Safeguards Agreement, and the JCPOA. When I spoke to him earlier, he invoked Article 26 and 36 of the JCPOA. What is absolutely crystal clear and indisputable is one thing. The JCPOA does say in these two articles that if there is significant non-performance and reimposition of sanctions, Iran will treat this as grounds to cease performing its commitments under the JCPOA in whole or in part. That's not an opinion, it's a fact. That's what it says in the JCPOA. It's crystal clear. Now, once again, this is something we've repeated 1,000 times, but it's true. Iran's remedial measures, whether that's increasing the cascades, its number of centrifuges, or enriching uranium past 3.67%, these are things that are all part of the deal. So the Americans may not like it, the Europeans may not like it, and the Western press may lie about it. But Iran has, in fact, stuck to the deal the entire way through, even when scaling up its nuclear program, because it has the right to do so after the Americans left. Iran never left the deal. So if the Americans and Europeans want Iran to scale back its nuclear program, the U.S. is going to have to re-enter the nuclear accord first. The only reason the other parties are at the negotiating table with Iran in the first place is precisely because Iran has leverage, and they're not giving that up. Why should they, when they're allowed to have it under the JCPOA? Dr. Baghri was unequivocal. The ball is now in the Americans' court. Coming to you directly from Vienna, thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As cases spread and countries plan their response, researchers await crucial data on the severity of the disease caused by the coronavirus variant. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Heidi Ledford Ryder. This article is published under the heading, How Severe Are Omicron Infections? Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. It has been less than 4 weeks since the announcement that a mutation-laden coronavirus variant had been discovered in southern Africa. Since then, dozens of countries around the world have reported Omicron cases, including a worrying number of infections in people who have either been vaccinated or experienced previous SARS-CoV-2 infections. But as political leaders and public health officials try to chart a course through oncoming Omicron surges, they must do so without a firm answer to a key question. How severe will those Omicron infections be? So far, the data are scarce and incomplete. There is inevitably a lag between infection and hospitalization, says infectious disease epidemiologist Mark Woolhouse at the University of Edinburgh, UK. In the meantime, policy decisions have to be made, and that's not as straightforward, he said. Early results suggest a glimmer of hope. Reports from South Africa have consistently noted a lower rate of hospitalization as a result of Omicron infections compared with infections caused by the Delta variant, which is currently responsible for most SARS-CoV-2 infections globally. On December 14th, the South African private health insurer Discovery Health in Johannesburg announced that hospitalization risk has been 29% lower among people infected with Omicron compared with people infected with a previous variant. This has fueled suggestions that Omicron causes milder disease than previous variants. But researchers say it is too early to be sure, and key methodological details of data study have not yet been published. Such details are crucial when interpreting data on disease severity, which can be confounded by factors such as hospital capacity, the age and overall health of those initially infected, and the extent of previous exposure to coronavirus. But the results from Discovery Health are in keeping with other studies in the country, says Vasila Jasset, a clinician and public health specialist at the National Institute for Communicable Diseases in Johannesburg. She says there are many caveats and disclaimers around early severity data, but the picture is very consistent. It will take time for a consistent picture to emerge from countries that currently have fewer Omicron infections. On December 13th, Denmark released data showing that hospitalization rates for people infected with Omicron seem to be on a par with those for people infected with other variants. But this comparison was based on only about 3,400 cases of Omicron infection and 37 hospitalizations. Similarly, a 16th of December report from Imperial College London found no evidence of diminished hospitalizations from Omicron infections compared with Delta in England, although this was again based on relatively few cases. Overall, the numbers are still too small to draw firm conclusions about the severity of disease caused by Omicron, says Trolles Libeck, an infectious disease specialist at the University of Copenhagen. And the rapidly spreading variant could dangerously strain healthcare systems, even if the risk of severe disease or death is relatively low for any individual. Woolhouse says a small fraction of a very large number is still a large number, so the population-level threat is very real. South Africa's optimistic data might not be a sign that Omicron itself is more benign than previous variants. More than 70% of the population in regions heavily infected with Omicron have had previous exposure to SARS-CoV-2, and about 40% have received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, says Jasset. This makes it difficult to disentangle the effects of pre-existing immunity from inherent properties of the variant itself. Lab studies have suggested that Omicron might be able to evade some COVID vaccine-induced immunity. And early data from the UK Health Security Agency suggests that the vaccines are not as protective against Omicron infections as they have been against other variants, although the number of cases studied was too small to be sure about how much protection has decreased. Even so, vaccines could continue to protect many recipients from severe disease and death from COVID-19. In addition to antibodies, the immune system in previously infected and vaccinated people deploys cells called T cells that can recognize fragments of viral proteins and destroy virus-infected cells, potentially limiting the scope of an infection. Researchers have mapped Omicron's panoply of mutations onto the menu of SARS-CoV-2 protein fragments recognized by T cells following natural infection and vaccination, and found no mutations in most of these fragments. In the case of vaccination, more than 70% of the fragments are fully intact, according to immunologist Alessandro Sett at the La Jolla Institute for Immunology in California. There is more work to be done. Scientists are already conducting lab assays to determine how well T cells generated in response to vaccines and infection with other variants react to Omicron, with results expected in coming weeks. I'm optimistic that the reactivity is going to be preserved, at least in part, Seth says, adding, how much of it will be preserved remains to be seen. At the moment, there is no way to draw a direct line between the degree of T-cell reactivity and protection against severe disease. Previous studies have found that robust T-cell reactions to SARS-CoV-2 are correlated with lower viral loads and less severe disease, but do not establish a threshold at which that protection might begin to wane, Seth says. Ultimately, it will again come down to waiting for data on hospitalizations and deaths from Omicron. As those data emerge, researchers will be looking particularly at the effects of Omicron on children. Results from South Africa have suggested that hospitalization rates for children infected with Omicron are higher than were seen in previous waves. But researchers again caution that this does not necessarily mean that children are more vulnerable to Omicron than they were to Delta or other variants. Gesed notes that children have lower rates of previous coronavirus infection and vaccination than results, meaning that their levels of pre-existing immunity are not as high. Higher rates of hospitalization in children during the early stages of an outbreak could also reflect more hospital capacity, affording the luxury of keeping a child in for observation who might otherwise be sent home, she adds. And the setting in which children are exposed can also play a part. Extended exposures at home from an infected parent could mean a higher initial exposure to the virus than a transient exposure at school, says David Dowdy, an infectious disease epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in Baltimore, Maryland. He says everyone is focused on the pathogen here, but it's not just about the variant, it's also about the host and the environment.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part, we looked into the adverse effects and potential dangers of psychotropic drugs. We went to France, the number one user of such medication, to see how psychotropic drugs prescribed much too readily and in a cocktail to cure feelings of anxiety and depression have in some cases led to madness, suicide, extreme acts of violence, and murder. Yet the root cause of the extensive use of such drugs seems to be much more than naive and ignorant doctors and desperate patients, especially when a multi-million dollar industry is at stake. Stay with us for the rest of the documentary.
In the Congress room, many conferences take place one after another, but nobody is dealing with the dangers of antidepressants. One of them is led by Anthony Rothschild, a psychiatrist well known for his successful books on psychotropic drugs. The great specialist is holding a debate on the adaptation of treatments depending on the illness. But not once does he say that antidepressants should not be prescribed. Our question is straightforward.
It seems that there is a lot of danger with antidepressants. What do you think about this? Like suicide or, murders?
No, I don't know what you're talking about, but I just told you there's no reliable scientific evidence that antidepressants cause people to commit murder or any other crime or suicide.
So how come that on boxes?
All right, this is not serious, okay?
Is this a surprising reaction? Anthony Rothschild also has conflicts of interest with an impressive number of pharmaceutical companies.
So I told you what I thought. You're going to keep asking me the same question.
Okay,
well, you got my quote, all right?
Okay, very good.
How can such things still be said in this day and age when on all the stands promoting psychotropic medication, whole boards are covered by signs warning of side effects? Among the several side effects, the risk of suicide or violent behavior is prioritized by all. These warnings are a legal obligation enforced by medical organizations. But how much are these warnings worth next to the publicity hype from the pharmaceutical companies?
When you're depressed, where do you want to go? Nowhere. Who do you feel like seeing? No one. Depression hurts in so many ways.
These ads banned in France reach tens of millions of households in the United States, one of the rare countries where the promotion of medication is allowed. For the promoters of these ads, a new customer is a captive customer. This is what Michael Baum denounces, a lawyer specializing in the pharmaceutical industry. This man is a nightmare for the laboratories. His trials have cost them billions of dollars. His theme, denouncing the addictive effects of medication.
One of the issues with these drugs is once you're on, you can't get off. They become a captive audience. And they get trained, basically, the patients get trained to stay on it. It's if they take the drug and then stop the drug, they start experiencing these brain zaps, or they start experiencing these nausea symptoms or these severe headaches or dizziness. And then they take the drug, they go back on it, and it goes away. Well, they get reinforced with the concept of, I need to stay on it. And they think that maybe, and what doctors used to think, was that they were relapsing back into their depression. That isn't what was happening at all.
The dangers of psychotropic drugs have been well known for a long time. Since September 1991, the American Medication Agency has had to react against waves of complaints against Prozac, the grandfather of modern antidepressants. This drug has been blamed for hundreds of suicides and murders, and administration officials are getting together to determine whether a correlation exists between Prozac and acts of violence. In front of this committee of reputed psychiatrists are the families of victims.
My husband didn't believe me. He was a pharmacist. We came back, and on April 30, he just blew his brains out in front of all of us. How many more have to die before somebody looks? If we made a mistake, we're humans.
After being on Prozac for 21 days, my wife shot and killed both of these two boys right here. She turned the gun to herself and shot herself twice. I heard these people talking about scientific data. For those that don't say we have scientific data.
I entered therapy 1 year ago as a victim of rape. I stand before you today a victim of Prozac. It baffles my mind to think that a prescription drug I could simply compare to a felony of rape. But yes, they can be compared, because if a drug robs you of your will to live, then it has committed a felony equal to that of rape.
She shot herself in the head.
This was the date of my first...
For a whole day, witnesses will make statements. It's overwhelming.
I firmly believe the drug...
The internist.
How many more people are going to be killed and maimed before you do something? You have the power to change things. You have the power to listen to what we say and investigate what we say. We need help.
Following the statements, the committee votes.
There is credible evidence to support a conclusion that antidepressant drugs cause the emergence and or intensification of suicidality and or other violent behaviors. Those in favor of that statement vote yes. Those opposed to that statement, no.
There is total surprise. Unanimously, the committee declares that there is no link between Prozac and the violence described by the families of the victims.
A vote on the following statement.
Jeffrey Lieberman is a member of the committee. Later, he goes on to be the all-powerful president of the American Psychiatric Association. And of the 10 psychiatrists present during the vote, 9 of them had conflicts of interest with one or several pharmaceutical companies. When Prozac was launched, the Lilly Pharmaceutical Company worked very hard. But one of the board directors even denounced the methods he had himself used to boost sales of the drug. He is John Virapen, and he was director of Lilly in Sweden until 1988. And it's not his style to beat around the bush.
We're not patients, we're consumers. And we're being ripped off right, left, and center. And unfortunately, as I see it today, the drug companies have the power, total power. They are in all corners of the industrial complex. They're in there somewhere doing dirty work.
And you were a part of it.
And I was a part. That's why I'm able to tell you all of this. I was a part of it. I've done, my hands are dirty. I'm trying to clean now. It's redemption time.
It's time for redemption. And John Virapen has written a book with a provocative title, Side Effects, Death. Notably, it discusses the way in which he was asked to conceal side effects.
The doctors prescribe to the patients, but don't tell them anything because they don't know. They rely completely on what the pharma industry tells them. These little salesmen that run around, I was a salesman too, and they used to instruct me when I was a salesman. The first thing is, you don't talk side effects with doctors.
Why do they do that? Because they want to make money, 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 money. They don't care about your lives. They only care about their wallets.
From conferences to interviews, John Virapen does not hesitate to reveal what he implemented to encourage sales, corruption, gifts, and trips.
To children. General practitioners, they don't usually get to go to them big Congress and World Congress here and there. So one day I got the idea that maybe we should do something with these guys. So I gathered a whole bunch of them and took them to Singapore. Fly them down to Singapore and gave them the works. I mean, it was exclusive. When they came back, my sales escalated.
In light of these accusations, Lilly, the lab that created Prozac, did not wish to meet with us. But this is what they said by email. John Virapen has not been employed by Lilly since 1988. He therefore cannot be considered as a credible source of information concerning the current activities of the group, its motives, or practices. The Lilly Pharmaceutical Company, like all the others, nevertheless fought hard so that the American administration did not impose a black box warning on antidepressant leaflets, an explicit caution against the risks of suicide or violent behavior. But in 2004, finally, it became a done deal. This victory is owed to the activism of victims' families and their lawyers, such as Andy Vickery. The pharmaceutical industry also has a bone to pick with this Texan. also received billions in compensation during the famous arrangements whereby laboratories preferred to pay out rather than stand trial. To better explain how a pill can kill, he makes use of a puzzle. His demonstration, he claims, applies for all psychotropic drugs.
Is there a phenomenon, a distinct phenomenon, of Prozac-induced suicide? The first attribute is the patients became suddenly suicidal. People who never thought of killing themselves, of harming themselves, take one of these drugs, whoom, they go instantly from that feeling to death. The second piece of the puzzle was that the suicides were all violent. I've shared with you already the story of Pat Williamson. She was on Prozac 9 days when she came in one morning to her husband and said, "Honey, would you show me how to kill myself?" And her husband said, "Oh, Pat, please." And he decides to go check up on her after 15 or 20 minutes and finds that she has made 100 mutilating cuts. Mutilating cuts in her body. The third piece of the puzzle that Eli Lilly noticed was an obsessive quality to the act. There's just this sudden impulse to do something really violent, really dangerous to themselves or others, and it's just, they're just overwhelmed by it. They're obsessed with the idea. And they cannot control their behavior. In the period of time between the person starts to take the drug and the time of their death or suicide attempt, that there's abnormal behavior. Something different is going on. And sometimes the medical help is, "Oh, you just need to take more of this drug. Let's increase your dose." It's like, "Oh, there's a little fire. Let's pour some gasoline on it." And the final piece of the puzzle is, almost all of the cases that I have handled, the death has happened within 30 days of the time the person either started the drug or had their dose increased.
Once again, Lilly Laboratory only answers our accusations by mail. They explain that one of the most striking studies in the last few years shows that there is a decrease in suicide, -32%, and in mortality, -49%, when depressed patients take antidepressants. But what is the truth? This study is contested by other studies that claim the contrary. And if in the United States, thousands of victims came to the forefront, then why would France be spared, the leading consumer worldwide of psychotropic drugs? In April 2014, a court trial would clarify the current state of affairs in an enlightening manner. Back in December 2008, Jean is depressed. He struggles to deal with his professional life. And at the birth of his son, he attempts suicide. He therefore went to the psychiatrist, Dr. Gossaris. The doctor recommends that he try out a new antidepressant, which was not yet available on the market, Brintellix. Jean did not react to the treatment. The psychiatrist proposed to double the dosage. A few days later, Jean set himself on fire. Corinne, Jean's wife, refused to believe that it was a random suicide. She alerted the authorities, and Dr. Gossaris was put under inspection on 7 charges. He was accused of embezzlement, but worse, putting others' lives in danger for at least 8 patients, including Jean, Corinne's husband. On April 30th, 2014, the doctor was strangely judged in Bordeaux, the court where he himself was a judiciary expert. He received a suspended sentence of 6 months that he appealed. But why would the pharmaceutical company Lundbeck, the creators of the antidepressants, not be investigated themselves? The pharmaceutical company Lundbeck has no interest in this affair going public. They've invested millions in order to get Brintellix approved by medical authorities. However, Jean was not at all the same since his dosage of Brintellix was raised, as described by Corinne and her mother. For Lundbeck, it is therefore not Brintellix that is to blame, but Jean's depression. It's a credible defense, which is used by all pharmaceutical companies when they are blamed. However, we also met with other victims of this trial period, and bizarrely, they all describe the same symptoms. Such as Christian Mounier, who also tested Brintellix for 8 months. Since, he has lost his job, his memory, and he describes himself as a vegetable. A man who is no longer himself, another who commits suicide, apparently devastating side effects for 8 sufferers. But there was also the suicide of 2 more patients just after coming off Brintellix. This bad streak should have alerted the authorities. However, nothing would come of it, as on the same day as Jean's self-immolation, Dr. Gosseres wiped his name from the file. His death was therefore no longer related to the clinical tests. The medical authorities explained to us that for each test of a drug, they only receive the results achieved across the whole territory. The botched trials of Dr. Gosseres were therefore lost in the mass and mixed with several other accepted studies across the world, as this document shows, that makes Brintellix's market release official. Lundbeck throws the blame back to the public health authorities. So what can be said of the package insert that we found in the United States, where Brintellix has been approved since 2013? Side effects are documented in 2 whole pages. Especially, though, the principal paragraph warns against the raised risk of suicidal thoughts and behaviors. It's the famous black box warning. In other words, the highest alert level. In France, Brintellix has just been approved for sale on the market. It has therefore been judged as useful in fighting depression. The doors are slammed shut. Jean is responsible for his own atrocious suicide. Just like the death of Mark, Aurélie's murderous thoughts and suicide attempt, or the fall of Christian Mounier. If the effectiveness of such medication on most serious depressive states cannot be denied, how many more tragedies need to occur before the effects of psychotropic drugs on some patients are truly recognized?
It seems that as long as money and power are involved in the realm of healthcare, pills that are expected to cure depression actually cause suicide and murder. And that's it for this week's program. Until next week and another Aperture, it's goodbye.